Well, I guess I should probably say that Mikhailov is probably irreplaceable, but nevertheless, I'm actually to some extent delighted that I can give this talk a bit earlier. This is a little bit of a recreational talk. It's about to some extent about 19th century mathematics, I think the context in which some of the classical questions actually popped up in the theory of nonlinear integrable PDEs, which is the main theme of this workshop, I think might be of some interest to you. Since this is a little bit of a recreational talk, as I already mentioned, I imagine that some of you might fall asleep, which is just fine. And if the speaker falls asleep, then I think we might actually make the history here. So I think we have a pretty good chance actually to enjoy the next 50 minutes. One way or another. The differential equation that got me started, PDE that got me started in this business, looks like this. U subscript T minus UX X T plus a second coefficient here, D plus 1 UX, and it's again the same B, UX, UX X, plus UXXXX, and we were told by people who work on asymptotic integrability that actually if P is viewed as a parameter, then there are two cases of integrable PDEs here, and the case B equals 2 corresponds to something called Kamasa-Holm equation, which I suppose is fairly well known to all of you, and then so this is Kamasa-Holm, and B equals 3 case, that's a relatively new case that was presented and discovered by Gasparis and Processi, I don't know how to actually put it, which I, of course, will abbreviate to DP. I will not talk about B equals 2 case. There will be other talks about this. I'd like to tell you a little bit about B equals 3 case. And as I said, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the ancient mathematics that actually this equation actually relates to, which I think is quite interesting. Equation with B equals 3 admits a Lax pair, and I'm going to write this Lax pair even though it's not the previous, but I'd like to emphasize, you know what, maybe I should actually do the following. Oh, okay, so... Well, that's not a very efficient way of using space, but anyway. So the equation that you get, the equations that you use, look like this. And then partial with respect to t of psi is equal to 1 over z, and then there's a constant here, second derivative with respect to x. Plus ux minus uux, and this is all acting on psi. M is related to u as follows. M is simply u minus uxx, which is something that one comes across also in Kamasa-Holm in the first equation. What happened was people who were interested in these two equations, they knew at least that for Kamasa-Holm equation, there is a rather peculiar situation that happens. Namely, you make an ansatz for u. So this is somewhat arbitrary, u of xt, of the form mk of t, an exponential minus x minus xk of t. A of the summation is, let's say, with respect to index k from 1 to some number n. And what happens is that if you substitute this type of ansatz into the equation just by brutal computation and a little bit of care with the fact that this is not, of course, sufficiently many times differentiable, so you have to interpret weakly some of the multiplications. But if you do that in a consistent way, it turns out that actually the equation is satisfied if and only if certain Hamiltonian equation, certain system of ODEs restricts the choice of mk of t and xk of t. And I'm just going to write what the system is. So the system that one gets is, so let's say dp, actually, let me put it like this, with this ansatz is actually equivalent to the following: xk dot is equal to summation mj e to the minus xj minus xk. And the second equation is mk dot is equal to 2 times the summation j equals 1 to n, mk mj. And then there is a sign of the difference. And you still have to multiply by this exponential. So anyway, we inherited this problem from people who work on it, and this is pretty much what we had at the very beginning. So this was done by other people, and let me just finish the sentence. So what happened was I worked on similar problems in the past, and this particular equation was of interest to me. So I worked with another guy whose name is Hans Lundmark, from the University of Linköping in Sweden, and we decided to take a serious look at what exactly the system of ODEs actually represents and what is actually happening here. Now, one of the interesting things about this system is that this is a cubic expression, this expression here, whose integrability condition formally gives you the equation. This this system actually is cubic, and I have some experience working with second order ODEs. With third order, we usually work with even orders. This is for obvious reasons that even problems with, you know, they are self-adjoined, et cetera, et cetera. So this looks, of course, there are cases with Boussinesq and so forth with third order, but this was a little bit strange actually to understand what is happening. What we did at the beginning was that we stared at the system of ODEs, and we managed to extract several very simple properties of this system of ODEs. We basically using very basic a priori estimates, and so let me just mention some of the properties. So these are very simple properties. Nevertheless, you will see that they are quite essential properties of the system. Let's call the system star for a second. I think I'm going to break all the chalk that we have here. So what are the properties? So here you have something rather interesting, that you can actually, first of all, the solutions exist globally, provided that the initial conditions are chosen in a particular way, which I will specify. So the following objects actually exist. Their limits exist for t going to plus or minus infinity, the following limits. Okay. And the second one is that the limit of positions, so as t goes to plus or minus infinity, xj minus xk is actually infinity. And three is that asymptotically, the positions behave as follows, that as mj plus or minus infinity times t plus big O of 1. So this is for t going to either plus or minus infinity. And these statements can be proven with some assumption about initial conditions. And the assumptions are as follows. The assumptions are that at the beginning, you can order, this you can always do, you have initial, let's say, positions ordered as follows, 2 and 0, say xn, 0. And then the other one is that all the m's at the beginning are actually strictly greater than 0. So this is the case for which you can easily make estimates on the equation and get the global existence of solutions as well as the existence of those limits. Now, what it means a little bit, intuitively, is that if you think of this as a system of particles with momenta m and positions xj, then this system, you see, exhibits a scattering, What it means is that you have particles that are localized somewhere, and then as time progresses, they actually separate. They separate, they scatter of one of another, and then in addition is that they become something like free particles asymptotically. So this system has this rather unique property. And this actually turned out to be a rather interesting and helpful observation. I never liked this particular form of the Fermi's equation. Not that there's something, there is anything fundamentally wrong with it, but I had some experience with Kamasa-Holm equation, on which I worked with actually David Sattinger and Dick Beals for quite a while actually, and we observed back then that this is not the most natural actually differential operator that you should consider. So what Hans and I did, Hans Lundmark and I did, we more or less used the same trick, which was basically to use some form of Liouville transformation on the first equation, on psi. Okay, so psi is this wave function. And this Liouville transformation maps the problem into a problem on a finite interval that looks like this. Minus phi, so I'm changing the wave function, y, and the new variable will be y, and then you have z, certain function g of y, phi of y, and the transformation contains hyperbolic tangent of x divided by 2, and there is a corresponding transformation of the wave function, 2 divided by 1 minus y squared, and this is phi of x. Okay. And this g, now, of course, since we are only interested in a particular class of solutions, then it turns out that the corresponding g that you actually obtain here is a measure. So g of y is simply a measure that can be written like this. Okay. And this GJs here, they are simply, they are essentially proportional to MKs or MJs that you have there. And this, with this assumption about the initial values of Ms being positive, in fact, this turns out to be a positive measure, with discrete, with finite support. So this is just a transformation on the level of ODEs. Now, the relevance of this transformation is the following. The relevance of this transformation is the following, that the boundary value problem, namely the one that I have over there, with the following initial, boundary conditions, phi of minus 1 is equal to phi subscript 1 minus 1 equals to phi of 1 equals 0, is isospectral. Isospectral relative to the deformation or to the T deformation. Formation equation, which is the DP flow. I'm talking about one eigenvalue z. This is 1 over z. Sorry, it's not a number 2, no. I do have 2 somewhere there, somewhere else. This is a genuine 2. I want the ZT. So, no, that's of course true. Yes, I'm sorry for that. Yeah. Now, is isospectral relative to this T deformation? And the spectrum spectrum actually consists of, well, real numbers, which you can order, lambda 1, which is the same actually as M1 at infinity, less than L2, M2 at infinity, etc. They're all distinct. Okay. So, now, this is a little bit surprising because, you see, this is a third-order problem, and a priori you wouldn't expect that the boundary value problem of this type actually gives rise to the real spectrum. So this problem, third-order problem, actually has a real spectrum, and the way this is one can actually see that is not direct. We have not produced so far a direct proof that this is the case. We just don't know how to do it. However, because the problem is isospectral, and we know a little bit about the isospectral deformation, we can actually extract information about the spectrum from the asymptotics of the deformation. So it's a very strange way of actually looking at a non-self-adjoint problem. This problem is, of course, non-self-adjoint. You can compute the adjointed. Sorry. Okay. So what you have here is that this G, effectively, what it has is that this is a measure, finitely supported measure. So this is like you are giving the measure, a finitely supported measure, and then what you do is you construct the spectrum of this operator. This problem is finite dimensional because of the nature of the coefficient. Right, this measure is not unrelated. Okay, what it is that you essentially this is a transformed M from the original equation. See, this U here is the solution that we are interested in. There is a relation between M and U, so you can compute what M is. Now, M will be a measure because U has absolute values here, so you're going to produce Dirac delta functions. Say it again. No, M is essentially, okay, M here is essentially sum of mk delta xk. Okay, when you put this, because of the exponentials, when you put this, if this were just exponentials, you would get zero. Because of the absolute value, you're going to produce Dirac delta functions. That's how it comes about. Sorry. Correct.
Later on the blackboard, M is a sum of delta functions in a particular example where it's
Right.
So M is a general measure below a particular measure.
How is your C relating to the B that we have?
Right, B is now, B is now chosen to be 3. And now B is chosen to be 3. The next thing is that people know what you know which equation you are trying to produce. I have no idea how they guessed this is written in one of our papers. I don't know exactly how they guessed this so-called lax pair. No, I don't think so. No, the what is special, I mean, these two cases, the claim is that these are the two cases for which you have infinitely many conservation laws. Only two, yeah. So this is, as far as I understand, this is a rigid. No, of course not. No, of course not. Yeah. All right. You guys are okay if this is going to be just an introduction to my talk, right? I do not know. Oh, you mean for the full equation? Yeah, I don't know that. I don't know that result. For B equals to 2, yes. the existence of solutions, that's, I think that's Constantine Escher. So for B equals 3, I do not know personally results related to the existence. You are thinking about global existence, right? For certain class of initial data. Yeah, or even local. No, I don't know that. This is a fairly new equation, so that can justify why there is a gap in my knowledge. I haven't caught up with new recent developments. Now, this C is a constant. It's of no relevance, actually. No matter what C is, five, put it 1. Okay, now, all right, so... let me then tell you a little bit about what is so what would be the what is then the actual goal? What is that we are trying to do? We are trying to, in some sense, to solve to solve this system of ODEs using the fact that there is an isospectral boundary value problem. So by this is a sort of standard part of philosophy in the integrable systems, that you are finding certain boundary value problem, and you try to see if there is actually a problem linearizes in some properly chosen space, a space of scattering data, and that's precisely what is happening here, except that, as you will see, this leads to an interesting inverse problem. Okay, so let me maybe state this result. So what one does is, and this was the experience that I gained working on Kamasa-Holm equation. It turns out that there is one, and in this case actually two objects that are of great interest from the point of view of solving the inverse problem. And basically in the case of DP equation, we'll have actually two wave functions that play an important role, and they are defined in a way that one would expect, namely that one takes phi, and this phi does not satisfy the boundary value problem on both sides. It satisfies the initial condition from taken from the left, and you keep the right-hand side open as usual, so this depends actually on z. Divided by phi of 1 and z, and 1, remember, is the endpoint. So you have minus 1. The problem is on minus 1 and plus 1, and we look at this ratio. And then, in fact, this is not enough. The second one that is needed is actually phi subscript yy 1 and z divided by phi of 1 and z. Okay. All right. Now, what in this particular case, these functions are rational, and what one can do is one can look at doing the essentially partial fraction decomposition for both, and what one gets. Let me just write this down in a particular way. So this will be k equals 0 to n. There's one extra eigenvalue because I want to write it in such a way that. 1 over this actually vanishes, 1 over w vanishes at infinity, and similarly z of z you write as z times something else, k equals 0 to n, let's call it ck, and this is z minus lambda k. Okay. And if you introduce these two objects, and this is in some sense the main reason why actually one studies boundary value problems, is that what happens now is that when you look at the time evolution, you of course discover, we already know that it's isospectral relative to the boundary value problem. But what is now more important is that for this particular choice of a boundary value problem, it actually turns out that the problem linearizes. And what it means is the following, is that of course eigenvalues are isospectral, but the coefficients in a partial fraction this expansion actually evolve linearly, exponentially. And this is B subscript K. And this is, now, the second one, CK. Well, Roughly speaking, what is happening is that the problem, when you actually count how many dimensions, how many degrees of freedom you have in the problem, you actually discover that even though this is a third order equation, you have, roughly speaking, 2n degrees of freedom, because you have two n positions and n coefficients in your measure. So what it means is that, in some sense, since here you have, I probably should have said that BK is always 1, here what you have is, you already have n coefficients and n eigenvalues. So you expect that, in fact, there should be a relation between Z and W, which is completely independent of the dynamics. However, it's very hard to actually get it. Now, it turns out that, again, if you use the flow, what happens, you can actually untangle a relation between Z and W. And the relation is as follows. Like, I'm going to write it down in terms of CKs, namely that CKs can be computed from the following formula. Namely, this is a sum, J equals 0 to N, BJ divided by lambda J plus lambda K. And this K, this is for K greater or equal to 1. Again, for C1, C0, there's some value which I don't remember. No, this is BK, no, that's of course wrong. What I meant by this is B0, if P is equal to 1. And then for K greater than 0, you have this formula. So in other words, one of the residue is not evolving, the remaining ones are evolving according to this. And using the isospectral deformation, you can actually solve the trig more or less that you solve certain system of ODEs. Now, from the system, you discover that this is completely independent of the deformation. So, in fact, you can compute the second Weyl function from the first Weyl function in a way that is not obvious at all. Anyway,
your eigenvalues
are to n. Right. This is because I'm introducing this fictitious z. So, you see, what it is that lambda equals 0 is 0. I'm multiplying and dividing because I want to have a partial fraction decomposition that vanishes at infinity. This is more historical than of any essence. I'm just used to working with this type of expansions. That's the only reason. So nothing deep. It's just this funny z here. I multiply and divide it by z, essentially. Okay. The main part of my talk was supposed to have been about the very fact that the inverse problem for this is actually related, and not only related, in fact, is almost equivalent to the problem of continued fractions and Pater approximants. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to skip part of it, and nevertheless, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the flavor of the subject, and in particular, what is happening with the solution to this. And what do I mean by solution? By solution, I mean the following. Look what is happening when you are solving the problem. You're starting from some time t equal to zero. You use you map the problem, the initial conditions, into BKs and lambda Ks. Then, as usual, what you do, you let this thing evolve with time, and then, when you are done, you would like to pull it back to reconstruct the positions and the ends. This is the same as reconstructing the measure for an arbitrary time. Now, in order to do that, you have to solve the inverse problem for this particular equation. Now, the inverse problem that you have here is a little bit strange. And there's not much literature on problems like this because this is an odd problem, okay? And perhaps it's not also obvious that it has anything to do with Pater approximants, but in fact it does. Now, in order to see a little bit what's going on, let me tell you a little bit about second order problem, on which I work with, as I said, with David and David Satterzee and Dick Beals. So let me just very briefly tell you about how continued fractions actually are related to spectral problems of the type that we have on the board.
Is
No, it's not arbitrary. An arbitrary measure, discrete. Correct. Right. Correct. So that n is the same as the initial ansatz in the. No, there's no more eigenvalues. The problem has only finitely many eigenvalues. No. No. This problem, because of the fact that the coefficient m in the original equation is actually a measure, a singular measure, this problem is actually finite dimensional. You have only, this is actually a matrix problem. Yes. So for Kamasa home, we have exactly the same situation. So, you know, this is a little bit like looking at a one-dimensional Schrödinger equation and I don't know, putting the delta potential or something like this. You're just going to have, these problems have only discrete spectrum. And then, of course, for a Schrödinger equation, what happens is, well, if you put a delta potential, you're going to have, I don't know, one eigenvalue, right? So you are controlling the discrete part of a spectrum if you put something really singular there. And that's precisely what happens here. Correct. But which you don't have here? No. Right. Okay, so this problem actually, as I said, is related to continued fraction expansion. Now, when you have it, so this is a very quick review of continued fraction expansions. And let me be very, very brief. In fact, I think I don't know when I started, but I think I'm about, am I supposed to finish right now? Or 10 minutes, thank you. So when you do continued fraction expansion, now initially I'm just talking about numbers. What you have is that, well, as you know, you start from a number, let's say an R, and then you essentially what you do is you decompose this number into its integral part and a fractional part. And the main thing, of course, is that what happens is that this fractional part is then gets written in a particular way. I'm sorry, 1 divided by 1 over fractional part of alpha. Now, this fractional part initially is, of course, less than 1, and then in actual value, and then what happens is that this is your first, what you call the reminder, R1, and then what you do is you repeat the process. You take R1, you look at this, you look at the integral part and so forth, and this is how you produce a continued fraction expansion of an arbitrary number alpha. So what you end up having is I'm now thinking about, let's say, numbers between 0 and 1. So you will end up having certain decomposition, let's call it A1. So this would be, in this particular case, this would be A1. Again, assuming that I'm between 0 and 1. And then you produce a bunch of numbers, A2, etc. Sorry, okay, like this. Which very often one writes as follows, A1 plus, this of course is much easier, A2 plus, etc., etc. Now this, as you know, terminates all these numbers, A with subscript J, these are natural numbers, and if the initial number alpha is rational, then this process terminates, and in fact is identical to the Euclidean algorithm. Now, in general, of course, if it doesn't terminate, that you are dealing with an irrational number. What is interesting about this process is that in this process, when you are doing actually this expansion, you are producing certain rational approximants to your number, and these rational approximants, you should think of them as basically being intervals. They define intervals which get closer and closer to the number alpha. So alpha is always inside a given interval, and then in the next step or next two steps of the continued fraction expansion, you are lowering the size of the of this interval that encloses alpha. In other words, there are certain approximants that you are considering, and these approximants more or less work like this: that one even ones estimate from below, and the upper one, the odd ones estimate from above. So there's an approximation problem that one is solving simultaneously within this process. Now, what is perhaps not so well known is that problems like this are actually connected with multiplication of special classes of 2x2 matrices. And I'd like to emphasize this, because in fact this is how one gets intuition about what one needs to do in this problem. So how is that we are actually getting 2x2 matrices? Well, the way this happens is related precisely to those approximants that I should have mentioned, but I didn't. Approximants are defined as follows. So this is what you do is you truncate your expansion, and what you get is you get certain rational number, which you write as Pn divided by Qn. Okay? So these are, and this is basically in our notation, this will be 1 over A1 plus 1 over A2, okay, till you hit AN. And you think of this as a numerator and this as a denominator. And the main thing is, of course, that those numerators and denominators satisfy certain three-term recurrence relations. So, for example, we can write them as follows. Pn is equal to An Pn minus 1 plus Pn minus 2. And this is Qn is equal to An Qn minus 1 plus Qn minus 2. And it is very clear when you look at the system of these recurrence relations is that you can actually write it in a form, let's say like this, Pn and Pn and Pn minus 1. And then what you have here is you start iterating what it means, and you get this. And then, of course, this would be Pn minus 1, Pn minus 1, Pn minus 2. And so the matrices, the 2x2 matrices that I was referring to that appear in the problem of continued fractions are matrices exactly of this type. So what you're going to have is A1, 1, 1, 0, and this will be An, 1, 1, 0, and then this will be acting on a particular initial condition, whatever it has to be, 0, 1 or something. So multiplication of matrices of this type is the same as doing a continued fraction expansion. However, and this is where the relation to the boundary value problems actually comes in, which is not so obvious, is that when you look at the structure of matrices, you might discover the following a very neat property, namely that I guess for this particular one, actually I should have put here what it was. This was 0, 1, 1, 0. And let me just, okay, so I, okay, this should be 0, 1. There's an exactly the same type of relation for Qn's, which are the denominators in Qn minus 1. And then this will be 1, 0. And my point is the following. When you look at this product, then you discover that it has you can write it in a different way. Namely, if you multiply this product by a matrix, let's say on this side, a matrix 0, 1, 1, 0, then what is going to happen is that you're going to get a matrix that looks like this. Let's see, I don't want to make a mistake. So this is A1, 0, and 1. And if you multiply this from the other side, you get a matrix that looks like A2, 1, 0, sorry. And then you get a matrix that looks like, I'm sorry, I wanted to multiply on this side, so 1, 0. And what you get is 1, 1, 0, and A2. In other words, all these products, now this matrix that you are multiplying by, 0, 1, 1, 0, has the property that its square is equal to 1. So what happens is, in fact, rather than viewing as a product of symmetric matrices of this type, you can view it as a product of factors. One is strictly upper triangular, the other one is strictly lower triangular. Now, where do I have a problem like this? Well, there is a problem like this appearing in boundary value problems. Namely, if you solve an equation that almost looks like this, except that it has a second derivative here, this is also a measure supported on discrete number, on finite number of points, discrete measure, and then you kill this, and you have this, then you will discover that indeed what is happening is that you are precisely getting matrices of this type. And let me show you very quickly why this is so. And then I think I should just tell you that it actually works in a very interesting way when you go to the third order case. But let me just show you why this is the case. You see, if you are starting at a point minus 1 and your first math is at the point y1, then what you do in order to end up here, so let's just write you are solving a problem that you'd like to compute it at a point y1, and let's say y prime y1, this will be on the left, minus 0. Okay? Well, then, of course, the way to get it is the following. For this particular problem, you would set, okay, you can get it as follows, that this will be 1, and in this case, this will be, let's call it a lambda, I'm sorry. This distance will be, let's say, L1, and L1 and 0 and 1, and this will be acting on phi at minus 1, phi prime at minus 1. Okay, so for the Dirichlet problem, you will this matrix will appear when you are going from the left end to the first mass. When you are now going through the mass, where the M appears, then what happens is all that you have to do is you have to compute Y1 and you have to compute phi prime Y1 plus 0 on the other side, and then what you get is the only thing that you have to put is the fact that the mass is there, which amounts to the following. This is a second order. The presence of mass is the same as a jump in the first derivative. So what it means is that there is a jump, and if there is a jump, then this is what you're going to have to put there, I guess with a minus sign, if I'm not mistaken, or G1. And then this will be acting on this. So this is... Okay. And this is how the... There's a fact that this is not 2, this is Z. Yes. So the answer to your question is yes, there's a factor of Z. But it's already taken into account. So minus Z. So as you see, when you are solving a classical string problem with discrete masses, what you are doing right away, you are doing a continued fraction expansion. This is one way of seeing what is happening. Now, I already exceeded, I think, my time. So now let me just very quickly tell you what is happening when you go to the third order. To the third order, what happens is you're also going to have factors that look very much like this, except that they are blown up to dimension 3. They also be products of factors which are strictly upper triangular and strictly lower triangular. And what you will be doing would be a simultaneous approximation of two value functions. And the result of this work with Hans Lundmark is that we actually did solve the problem, the inverse problem for this case. And the inverse problem leads to a new type of Padé approximants that is tailor-made to precisely this very problem. This is like a higher order generalization of continued fractions, which is in some sense guided by this particular way of associating continued fractions with a mechanical problem. Yeah. And the reason why it's 3 is, of course, because it's a third order equation. No, they have 3. Right. Now, it turns out that problems similar to this for numbers were studied. The problems by, of course, this goes back to Jacobi and Hermite. I had this in my presentation, but never mind. And so the problems I think we study are very interesting problems in number theory that lead to simultaneous approximations of numbers. In this case, it will be two numbers. In our case, we have two functions. The main difference between what has been done and what we were led to is the following, that the order of Padé approximants that you are using here is very, very low. It's so low that normally in books on Padé approximants, you don't even deal with those because there's nothing interesting, it seems. Because you don't know if there's uniqueness, if you can construct those approximants. I mean, you can construct, but there's too many of them. Well, it turns out that because of how restrictive the problem is, there is a uniqueness. That means there is only one type of approximants that really solve the inverse problem. Anyway, thank you very much, and sorry for...